I'm Tim Yancey, inviting you to explore the fascinating realm of the paranormal, ghosts and hauntings, Bigfoot, UFOs, and alien abductions. Join me live every Sunday evening at 9 p.m. with the foremost authorities and experts in the world regarding the mysterious realm of the unexplained. The Encounters Paranormal Radio Series, as heard on WBZT 1230 AM. EncountersBroadcasting.com.
Hi, this is Luke.
And this is Tobin from Quest Research.
Hey, Tobin, what do you get when four guys with absolutely no video experience whatsoever decide to produce their own online paranormal TV show?
I don't know. What? Oh, wait. I do know. Ghost Diaries, right?
That's right.
You can check us out and get involved at www.questresearch.net. And the good thing about being new is that we will only get better.
Don't be caught bored waiting for something to go bump in the night. Listen to the Paranormal Broadcast System with Brad, Brandon, Todd, and Paul.
Well, hello, Mr. Fancy Pants.
Listen to some great interviews with some amazing guests that run the gamut from ghost hunting groups across the country to paranormal personalities in the media. First, let's be serious for a moment. Then let's have some fun! We've got it all covered. Tune in and listen to intriguing interviews with our hosts from LA Spirits and the Louisiana Spectral Research Center. Then kick back and listen to us try to be funny with some crazy Cajuns. And some other guys, too. This is no kid show, folks. It's the Paranormal Broadcast System. Listen to us poke fun at ourselves. It's funnier that way. You can find us at www.lagghosts.com. That's www.lagghost.com.
This is Ghostly Talk.
We're getting it right now.
That's much better.
Oh, that's
finally,
nice.
Finally, after 7 years.
I can do a slow fade.
Practice makes
my
perfect.
Fingers are like butter on the board.
Oh, my. No comment.
I don't want to think about that.
You know, whatever. All right. I am an engineer.
Have we introduced ourselves at all this show?
This is Scott L.
And I'm
just killed
John.
You heard what I just did? I just destroyed
and
it.
And I'm Bonnie.
Thank you. Yeah.
Who do we have? Who do we have here?
We have Deborah
Blum. Somebody who's going to make some sense.
I hope so.
Yes.
Deborah Blum is a Pulitzer Prize winning science writer and has been a professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison since 1997. She earned her bachelor's in journalism from the University of Georgia in 1976 with a double minor in anthropology and political science. From 18...
You're going to get us in trouble.
I know,
bro.
I'm talking about my life. From 1982 to 1984, she worked as an environment science writer at the Fresno Bee in California. In 1984, she became the first full-time science writer at the Sacramento Bee, where she stayed until joining the UW faculty. Blum then wrote a series on ethical issues and the dilemmas of primate research, The Monkey Wars, which won the 1992 Pulitzer Prize, the 1992 Science Writing Award of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, and the 1992 Clarion Award from Women in Communications. Her latest book, Ghost Hunters, William James and the Scientific Search for Life After Death, was named one of the 50 hot books of summer in Entertainment Weekly's Summer Reading Preview Edition. If it's as hot as it is in this room right now, it is flying off the shelves. The website that we could find for you, Deborah, was www.journalism.wisc.edu/users/dblum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we can link up, or we can link
yeah,
up
we'll link
whatever
up.
You want us to at our website
mm-hmm.
so that people have something to click on and go to.
Welcome to the show, Deborah.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, Doug actually said a mouthful there.
You copy and pasted it from the web.
That's why I love doing that, because I know I'm going to torture you with it when we do the show. But no, that's obviously you've done a lot of work here, and you know, let's just jump right out of the gate.
From
here,
primates
yeah.
to ghosts.
This, yeah,
it's just incredible. I mean, this was serious work, right? What you would consider, you know, completely in the heart of science to ghost hunters, William James and the Scientific Search for Life After Death. You must have a short attention span. I was going to say an outlook on it that a lot of us don't have, because I've been, you know, I haven't done like serious hardcore science studies since, you know, they tell you what to do in high school.
Didn't you invent the wheel, Doug?
Well, after the wheel. After the wheel. And then I haven't done any more experiments after that. And So I'm like, you know, so you must have a really interesting, you know, outlook on ghosts and things. I mean, having come from doing all that wonderful science and journalism.
Yeah, I mean, really, how would you go from doing, you know, doing mainstream science like that and decide to do a book like we're talking about, kind of the supernatural? How would you do a shit like that?
Yeah, a lot of people ask me that, and, you know, my mainstream kind of science writer friends worried that I had somehow meandered off onto the dark side or something. I'm really interested in general in the sort of intersection between science and society, how science helps define us, how we define science, and if you kind of look at the what is going to genuinely look at the sort of bizarre track of my work. I did monkeys. I wrote a book on biology of sex differences. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book on love and affection. I did the poison, this ghost book, and my current book that is coming out next year is about poison. Mm-hmm. You would say, here's a woman who, you know, can't make up her mind. Mm-hmm. But I'm really interested in that point where science and society come together and one influences the other. And that really was what got me started thinking about, well, they called it psychical research then, and we would probably call it paranormal work now. Mm-hmm. The kind of idea that, you know, for me, it was, here's the best ghost hunt in the history of science, and I just wanted to know what they found. And then, if it really is the best ghost hunt in the history of science, shouldn't it have changed the world? So both of those were kind of on my mind when I started doing the project.
And this, yeah, this was on a particular ghost hunt. Obviously, William James had a part in this. And again, it just want to go ahead, Doug. Good.
No, I was just going to say the problem is that society right now.
You're going to start giving her a hard time already, Doug.
No, not her a hard time. I'm giving society and scientists a hard time. No, everybody else.
You're going to sit her screaming in about 2 minutes. Great.
Society tends to, at least the part of society that I hang out with, right? I hang out with ghost hunters and people with, you know, interesting theories and fringe theories and stuff like that. So I hang out with, you know, probably the people who, but then again, I also hang out with people who go to bingo and people who are shopping in line at you at the who go to meat raffles and people who are shopping in front of you and, you know, at the store. And I hang out with everyday people and I hang out with, you know, some fringe scientists and things like that. The people that I talk to tend to blame hardcore science for not looking into this. Like, you guys, there's literally, since man has been on the face of the earth and writing things down and chiseling in rock, they have been taught and telling stories around the campfire, they have been talking about ghosts and they have been talking about incest and about this. Why aren't you looking into this? So we've got society just raising up their arms, and then you've got science probably, you know, I don't know exactly what they're doing, but they're probably doing something similar in that, why are you bothering me with this stuff? I've got cancer to cure. I don't know what they're doing, but so we've got two, you know, it doesn't seem like they're getting along.
It's very frustrating in a way, and it was interesting to me because I do usually hang out in, you know, that kind of nice, tidy mainstream science group. I realized when I started this book all at once, you know, the people in stores or the secretary in my department, or I went out and gave a talk at a Florida university. They had a haunted laboratory, right? That all of these people were telling me things that no one had told me in my career because they assumed that I would laugh at them, right? But once I started doing this book, I started picking up on all these amazing stories. And the really interesting thing, I will tell you, is that after I did the book, I was surprised at how receptive many people in the scientific community were. I mean, one of my favorite moments was I talked about it on Science Friday on NPR, you know, which is as mainstream as it gets. And the host is an old friend of mine, and so he called me up the day before, and he's going, Deborah, you know, I just don't think this is going to fly well with our audience. Deborah, I really think this is going to be a disaster. So I was a complete wreck when I went on the show. I could have killed him. But then people called in, swear, you know, engineers, and they wanted to talk about their, you know, their paranormal experiences. And you realize that, yeah, there's this level of kind of suppression of information, which was one of the things that I really liked about doing the book. You know, I felt like I had a lot of credibility. You know, you don't want to be buried with your credibility. What's the point of that? So that I could really raise some issues in the scientific community as well as out. And I could, and I had picked, watch me go on and on here, but I had picked this one moment in time with William James, you know, who's practically an institution, because I didn't want to have like the James Randis of the world breathing down my neck saying, oh no, I've checked that out, that's not real. I wanted to be able to write about it, you know, in a way that I could say, but look, this really looks real. Think about, you know, just think, be open-minded. So that was like one of my hidden goals in doing the book.
Well, I think it's, again, this approach, you know, from all the other work you've done outside of this, and then to come and move on to this. And I mean, I always like to point towards my favorite, you know, ghost book of all time, which is Haunted Houses by Larry Kettelkamp. You know that, Doug. And that was done by a guy, you know, who wrote that book, and then he went on to make a cookbook after that.
I like people like that.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously he had an interest in this, and he wrote this cool book that's the basis for a lot of the stuff I do now. But he, you know, he came in from outside, and he went into this realm for a time, did the book, and then he moved outside of it again. And I think that does add a lot of credibility, because that means that people outside, because, I mean, obviously there are a ton of publications nowadays on the paranormal, which includes lots of books being published, either, you know, being independently published or books that are being, you know, going through major publishers that are going out there. A lot of them are from people within the community, which is cool. They're going to be wrong. But there are people within the community. I don't know all the details, but you came from kind of the outside in and did this project. And that does, I think, kind of lend some credibility.
Although, Deborah, it had to tickle your imagination at some point. Something must have tickled. Were you watching the History Channel one October? Or what? Like, what, you know, because in October it's all haunted history. But what, something had to tickle your fancy at some point and say, you know, I really am interested in this. What, like, you know, like the primates, something had to be like, oh my gosh, I'm going to write about, you know, monkeys. So
right.
Something had to be.
Yeah, there has to
do
be.
Do you remember what it was that was like, hey, I want to delve into that?
Yes, and it wasn't, you know, I would love to tell you that I, you know, was out in the night and suddenly the universe illuminated, but it was really, I was working on my previous book, which is a history of psychology book, and I had gone in this nerdy way that I do way back in the history of psychology, and I kept seeing these references to William James having lost his mind, right? And I thought, boy, I didn't know William James had gone crazy. I thought he was like this, you know, kind of stuffy Boston Brahmin kind of guy.
Yeah.
And so I was just, you know, so I started looking at that a little bit, and this was the thing that I always, the real thing that changed my mind. I was bumming around down State Street, which is like this little funky street that connects the University of Wisconsin campus to the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And I went in this used bookstore, and this always makes me laugh, I don't know why, but they had William James on Psychical Research by Gardner Murphy. And it was like a couple weeks after I had started thinking, boy, that's weird. And I took this book on James home, and there was this amazing story, The Woman on the Bridge, which is actually the opening of my book, which you could stand on your head and not understand that something really strange had happened. And I thought, that is so perfectly inexplicable, and that's what I want to write about. So it was that moment, right, of finding this book kind of by pure serendipity and saying, that's the best ghost story I ever heard, and I'm going to tell it.
How interesting, because that does seem more like, you know, the groundwork was laid, and then this built up, and then happen to see this thing and pick up the book and you're reading it and wow and boom. I mean that does oftentimes make for the best books and so I'm really, really impressed.
I sold the book on the basis of that Woman on the Bridge story.
But when because obviously you did more than just read that one book. You had to go and talk places and learn from people and do a lot of reading. So when you're delving in reading probably many of the books that I've read in the past, did it seem like some of these folks in the history of psychical research were a bit crackpot-ish, if that's a word?
Well, some, right? I mean, if you look at, you know, one of the things I liked about the period was that it was so extreme in the way the professional media movement was, right? And it was in that Victorian period where everyone wanted manifestations. So, you know, you would go to a dark seance and little creepy ghost children would float around and there were catalogs for these kind of sleazy mediums to buy all kinds of luminous paint and things like this. Mm-hmm. There was actually one of my favorite was a medium who had a you in those days, remember women wore bustles?
Yeah.
She had a bustle that when she pulled a string, it would unfold into the face of a sort of ghostly child. And then, it, you know, she would, like, turn around backwards and this child face would loom out of the darkness. And then when she was done, she would, you know, uninflate her bustle, I guess, and, you know, it would disappear. I mean, it was fascinating. So against that, you know, you see this real, you know, incredible, I mean, it wasn't just subtle fraud, it was outrageous. And yet these guys, that was one of the things that was so interesting. These guys stuck with it anyway. I mean, William James, from the early 1880s until his death, and it was what they found beyond the fraud. And that was amazing to me, right? Mm-hmm. That despite all this sort of circus-like atmosphere, and they, you know, were disliked by a lot of the mediums of the day because they did debunk a lot of them, but there were these few things. They pretty much said, I thought about 5% of what they found was undisputably real. Mm-hmm. And it was that magic 5% that I started saying, you know, here's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, well, that's what it all comes down to, I think. And I think that there are presently, you know, we're going, and I've been asking people this, too. Did we talk about this last week, Doug? I think I asked one of our guests last week that, you know, I asked them, like, are we going through a spiritual revival?
We did. We talked about that, Deborah. We talked about that last week because the spiritualism movement, you know, back in the, you know, mid to late 1800s and then on into the early 1900s, and then, of course, it, you know, passed on or whatever. Well, although there's actually three spiritualism retreats still left.
But the one we think about with all the cool photos and all, you know, the imagery we have now.
That's the heyday, right?
The golden age, they call it.
So the golden age. Are we going through a similar thing only with a different shift because of the, you know, the TV medias and the, you know, going on with the shows on the TV, and then, of course, there's podcasts and radio shows like our own, and there's Coast to Coast AM, and there's, you know, are we going through yet another heyday with a different focus is what I'm wondering.
Yeah, you know, I've thought about that, you know, because there's been so much, like, a revival of it, and in across all kinds of spectrum. I think, yeah, that's partly true, and I think, you know, my own take is if you look at the Victorian times that we were talking about, you know, there was enormous kind of cultural and moral stresses at that time. You know, in that post-Darwinian doubting of faith kind of era. And you know, we live in a very stressful time where our standard institutions don't necessarily always win. I think in those times where you're not necessarily accepting the rules that have been laid down by society, people become more open-minded, right? They're willing to exceed, you know, to kind of expand the limits. And I do think we're in one of those periods, and I hope it's fruitful, actually.
Well, yeah. The reason I mentioned that is because there are, you know, the more I look at it, the more I think we are going through another type of movement like that. And we're also experiencing, and I see them every day, there are groups out there doing the same type of thing, where their sole job is to debunk, okay?
Right.
Sometimes the tactics, I don't agree with them that much. They can be downright rude sometimes. But I do think they serve a purpose. And it is to get to that. And I've talked to some of these people personally. We've had some of these people on the show. And they all say the same thing. They say, well, you know, look, we're trying to cut through all the noise and get to the good stuff that we can explain. We're not out to cut people's throats all the time. But we really want to see if there is something out there. If there isn't, well, we tried, right? But they're trying to get to that, like that 5% you were referring to. And I think that's very healthy to have, especially in this community. We need people like that.
Right, because in any time where you start seeing, I mean, I think you'd see this in anything, paranormal or not, you know, if it's a successful movement, mm-hmm. then you get people opportunistically trying to take advantage of it, and you do want to weed those people out. I mean, the tricky part, and this was certainly true in the period that I was looking at, is remembering that just because there are, you know, the world is full of con artists doesn't mean there's not something real there. And sometimes the debunking, you know, gets much more publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And the debunking fits much more into what you would think of as the standard structures of science. And to me, this is probably, you know, the biggest hurdle for acceptance is that paranormal events, they're not replicable, they're not necessarily predictable,
nope,
right?
Nope.
They don't fit in the standard model. So either we have to say, well, gee, you know, the standard model just isn't quite big enough, mm-hmm. and we need to adjust it some, or we have to accept that we're going to figure this out in a way that's not mainstream science entirely.
Mm-hmm.
But for it to be accepted in that kind of, you know, American Association for Advancement of Science way,
mm-hmm.
it's going to have to be something replicable, something predictable.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
There's no way around that. I mean, that is the basis of science, is it has to be repeated.
Right.
I was talking about Stephen Hawking earlier, and I was, you know, what I was trying to take in on the way home today in the car, and one of the things he did talk about was just what you're talking about, Deborah. He's like, and it's just, what Stephen Hawking pointed out, though, when it comes to a scientific theory, trying to prove it and make it into fact, is that the slightest variation, not just a, you know, mm-hmm. the slightest little difference from the last time you ran the experiment will totally blow it out the door. So it's these little things, and we have such a huge margin when it comes to ghosts and the paranormal and things like that. There's so many environmental factors that have to be taken into account that, frankly, I don't think all of us really, even the most seasoned investigators out there, I mean, the ones that we would consider seasoned, I mean, I don't want to call them professionals. There aren't professionals
right.
here. But even
the ones with experience, right?
Yeah, the ones with experience. The one thing I think we could point out, too, and this is, I just want to use an example because we're going to go to break here. Yeah, we got 1 minute,
okay.
Bonnie? Since when did you start looking at the clock?
Bonnie's our new timekeeper.
Because I felt the urge.
Okay.
You hadn't done it, so I thought I would.
No, one thing I want, before we go to break, this is another example I want to point out. Our world famous EVPs we've got.
Oh, we've got two.
We've been milking since 2004,
we have
right?
two EVPs.
But,
yeah.
you know, I still like to use them as examples, and for people that have an interest in this that I know, I go, well, here, check these things out. These are some really cool ones we got. And this, a couple of years ago, I let a friend hear these EVPs. And he literally came to me and said to me, he listened to it and said, Scott, and this is the one we were on the bridge, right, Doug?
Yeah.
And he said, Scott, it sounds like you totally faked this. It sounds like you recorded that voice on top of the audio track. Which I was like, I don't need to go into all that. Our listeners are going to kill me anyways, but they're going to lose their minds hearing this again. But they literally, we know that there was no, we didn't do anything like that.
Right.
We recorded this thing and it was picked up, right?
So with that one statement, it suddenly became a personal experience.
No.
Because
it
we know.
Well, no, I didn't take it personal because me, myself, I like to think that I can take that criticism, right?
Yeah.
I think the community at whole, and even the scientific community, this is where my point is, Deborah, is that that's where we, as soon as you attack someone on an intellectual level, and I don't mean attack as in an angry attack, but like, look, I think this is crap.
Yeah.
I don't think, but people take that personal.
And yet, you take a lot, we have to take a lot of science on pure faith. If you look at something like quantum mechanics, it's an enormous leap of faith to believe it really works. Right?
Oh, yeah, totally. Go ahead, Deborah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Deborah. You there?
No. I was agreeing with you because I found, one of the things that interested me a lot were, I think the EVPs are really interesting.
Yeah.
Or also what my guys call crisis apparitions and, you know, people sometimes call death visitants today.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a stunning kind of statistical tapestry of those events, right?
Mm-hmm.
To the point that you just have to say, okay, there's definitely something going on. But until we can find as with your EVPs, until we can find the explanation, right, the inarguable explanation, then people are always going to come up with little doubtful, fraudulent, or exceptions to the rule. It's very frustrating because sometimes I'll say to myself, what would it take actually to convince some of these people, right? I mean, the heavens would have to open up and ghosts walk among us.
Let's talk more about that after the break here because it is interesting.
Yeah.
We're definitely on the right track here. My voice is going.
Well, after the break, we'll have more with Deborah Bloom of, Ghost Hunters, William, I know I'm not even talking into the mic, I'm sorry. Ghost Hunters, William James, and the Scientific Search for Life After Death. More with Deborah after this break.
Miss a live broadcast? Feel free to download it direct from the on-demand archives at ghostlytalk.com.
Why do I get sick? How can I live a more balanced whole life? These are just a few of the questions explored each week by naturopath, medical intuitive, and clairvoyant Dr. Rita Louise on Just Energy Radio. Explore your possibilities every Friday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Standard Time. Join us at justenergyradio.com.
Shadow governments, strange rituals, new world order.
Shadow governments, strange
buried treasures,
new
planetary mind control, military
cover-up,
corporate
shadow governments, strange rituals, new world order, buried treasures, planetary mind control, corporate
Out there. It's a strange world.
Visit outthereradio.net for more information.
I feel the wind climb a mountain, Lord. I can see for miles around, but life's been tough. Complicated darkness moves at the speed of sound, but I want to live. I just can't give in. I've got to live. Now I know when I listen tonight. Oh, 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 the music soothes my restless soul. When I listen tonight, oh, 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 give me shelter from the storm. Oh, 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 oh. Now I've been down, blinded vision, thought I needed some time away, but escape's illusion is in a sense. I finally found it a different way, and I want to live. I just can't give in. I've got to live. Now I know when I listen tonight. Oh, 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 oh. The music soothes my restless soul. When I listen tonight, oh, 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 oh. Give me shelter from the storm. Oh, 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 oh. I'm aware that so much of life is beauty undercover, and I swear that I will survive, embrace you like a lover. When I listen tonight, whoa, 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 the music soothes my restless soul. When I listen tonight, whoa, whoa, give me shelter from the storm. Whoa, ho, 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 ho. Whoa, ho, ho, ho. When I listen tonight,
has learned that all people possess mental powers which pass the boundaries of the natural.
Ghosts, Bigfoot, extraterrestrials,
Terra Hub Radio,
psychics, parapsychology, Loch Ness Monster,
Terra Hub Radio,
paranormal news, giveaways, open chat,
Terra Hub Radio,
classic rock, and paranormal talk, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific, at parahub.org, bounceradio.net, and beastradio.com.
Interested in ghosts? UFO? How about the occult? Are you psychic? Would you like to find out? Well, if you're intrigued by the world's curiosities and all that is paranormal, then Paralore.com is a place for you. Create your own profile, start a photo album, write a blog, or just hang out and watch countless hours worth of paranormal videos while chatting with other Paralore members. Who knows? You could win a prize or two if you're quick and brave enough. It's all here, and it's all free. Visit www.paralore.com and join today. Again, membership is free, and we know you won't be disappointed.
Paralore.com. Unlock your mind.
Experience the soul into the blackness.
Kick Doug in the head. I think Doug.
I hear that a lot.
Is dead.
Hey, that's Hellmouth. That's a cool band for here from Detroit.
Yeah, absolutely.
My friend Jeff, an old friend, killer band. If you have not checked out their album, it's called Destroy Everything, Worship Nothing.
Ooh.
Yeah, real happy stuff. Thanks, Jeff. Our buddies here from Detroit.
Well, all independent music on Ghostly Talk, and yep. I dig that.
Yeah, check them out. Really cool.
We're talking to a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, professor of journalism, about ghosts.
We're still here, surprisingly.
Yeah, I know. Still here.
How about this chat?
We're talking about ghosts and ghost stories and how appealing they are and you know, ghosts in society. Mm-hmm. In particular, the book, Ghost Hunters, William James and the Scientific Search for Life After Death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating because you noticed this, Deborah, on your travels to do the book that you know, when people heard, you know, oh, I'm doing this book on you know, William James and life after death and ghosts and things, and people would be like, oh, I've got a ghost story for you, and just everybody right. like had this thing. I mean, it is so prevalent in society, and there is a body of literature. There is a lot of books on ghosts and things like that. And there's you know, you know, TV and literature and probably books on tape and just everything about
where?
About books. I know you want
that's my
that.
Thing right now. Hook me up,
but. But it's so prevalent, and our society, I think, is just now, like, talking about it. Because I remember, you know, when I was a kid, but we're talking decades and decades and decades ago, we would talk about, you know, ghosts and stuff, but they weren't in the newspaper. They weren't, you know, on the internet, because there was no internet. You would just hear, you know, so-and-so said so-and-so had some kind of experience. What do you think it was? Or, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, the biggest thing was when, you know, Uri Geller would be on morning TV, you know, and then...
Bending a spoon.
Right, bending a spoon, and then people would all...
He took a beating for that. But
and then he took a beating for that, but, you know...
Then he came on this show. That shows you what his career has went to.
Yeah.
But, oh, no.
But I have to say, the you know, it has been part of society, but it was so underground before, and now it seems to be picking up, and I'm really happy about that. But has anything really opened your eyes, or were you already at the point where, you know, this is something that we do talk about, you know, when something would come up at the movies or something would be on TV, or, like, did you already talk about it, or was this a newfound topic of conversation?
You know, the book was really a kind of transformative experience for me because I'm, you know, kind of boringly methodical in how I think about ideas, and I have to kind of work my way through them, and I'm a, you know, terrific over-researcher. I went off to Harvard and read all the William James letters, and I went to the archive at the American Society for Psychical Research, and I pulled all these antique kind of papers, and I had a wonderful time. I love doing research, and what I realized as I did it was that there was just this pattern of events or episodes that I couldn't explain away, that I thought there was something, you know, supernatural, supernormal, the natural we don't understand, that was absolutely legitimate there. And so that ended up being a kind of thread in my book, and it caused me to listen to people in a different way. It was interesting to me when you were talking about kind of public open-mindedness, but one of the places I gave a talk about this book went shortly after it came out was to the National Academy of Sciences, which is, you know, as upright as you get.
Yeah.
And they asked me to come out and be part of their Distinctive Voices lecture series. And I was talking about crisis apparitions, which I had mentioned before, and I was telling this story that actually involves my father-in-law, in which he woke up in the middle of the night, heard his cousin calling, woke his wife up, finally went out in the yard to look for his cousin and couldn't find him. It's about 3 a.m. And about 11 o'clock that morning, he got a call from his nephew, and his cousin had committed suicide at the time that he was wandering around the yard looking for him. Mm. Now, that's the only time that he's ever had that experience, and my father-in-law is the most grounded person in the world. So I was sharing that story as an example and comparing it to very similar stories from, you know, the 100-year-ago period of my book. And at one point, one of the women in the audience at the National Academy said, I wonder if you could just ask people to put up their hands if they've had that experience. And so I said, okay, everyone who has had that experience or who knows someone who has had that experience, put up your hand. And, you know, fully half the people in the room put up their hands. And I thought, this is so interesting. This is such an indication. You know, it was the least, a completely non-hostile audience. Now, I also wrote an op-ed for the LA Times in which I said, you know, boy, in the days of William James, you had the world's best scientists trying to pursue this. You had James, you had Roche, who was a Nobel laureate, you had Rayleigh, who was a Nobel laureate, you had Oliver Lodge, who was one of the inventors of radio. I mean, you had really incredible world-class minds. And even though I think there's some very fine scientists doing this now, why don't we try to get some of our, you know, Nobel laureates and super brains out there to take another look at this problem? Yeah, as you can imagine, I got a very mixed response. You know, from some scientists who said, I'm so glad you said that, and from some who said, you know, something that you referred to earlier, get a grip, we're trying to cure cancer, you know, we don't want to divert our money into this.
Well, and that's, so. I think that I was going to say that's what it comes down to, and I mean, in this day and age, it's a lot different than it was 100 years ago. And I got to be frank, I think, you know, and I can't blame a person who has 15 years of schooling behind them and a PhD to go, okay, look, I can go over here with my experience and my degree and all the stuff that I have accrued and make myself a lot of money. Okay,
right.
I can be
doing
very well
for
myself.
Money, but also, you know, do new power
prestige
systems and deliver.
Yeah, I can make. Yeah, I can. Yeah. I can really. You know, yeah, it's also
things that can help
career
other
things.
People.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that too. I mean, that's an obvious point. I hope, but I think really what it comes down to is a lot of people just say, "Look, I can do a lot better work over here instead of going over here
right.
and." Like you mentioned quantum physics and how do you get your head around that, you know, and things like that. And I think the paranormal kind of ties in with a lot of that, because a lot of these ideas, again, come down to, there's this thing called the residual haunting. I mean, a simple, well, what's a residual? Well, it's something that just kind of keeps coming back and coming back. Oh, okay, so what's coming back? Well, it's this thing. It could be a person. It could be, you know, it could be all, you know, just that little bit we've talked about, though. It's very intangible. Right?
Right.
There isn't
right.
a lot of meat on that to work with, and I think that's what may turn off a lot of these high, you know, the heavy hitters out there, is because it's something, I think, when you're that, when you have that much intelligence and you're that smart, you want to be able to put your hands on it or put your head around it, you know, more specifically.
Right.
I think that's a big problem we're going to have with that. It is a different age, though, too.
It is. And, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, sometimes I'll say to people, well, you know, if you would quit thinking of it so much as the weird, creepy supernatural and think of it as these natural abilities that we just don't understand, then you could say, well, we haven't developed the science to understand these, but it's not like, you know, bizarro magic. It's actually something legitimate. Now, that doesn't mean that something might be not be much bizarro magic for all I know. Mm-hmm. But the part I think that tends to interest me is that idea that there are these natural abilities and energies and that we don't understand. They're there. But here we are, here we are on this one small planet in an enormous universe. And we've come up with one particular system for measuring reality. And I think it's okay for us to say, well, gee, there's some hubris to that, right? I mean, we're on this tiny little pale blue dot, as Carl Sagan used to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of ego to say, yes, and we absolutely have worked out the entire system for measuring all of reality. Because I don't think we have. And that, I think, is a very reasonable place, even for the most mainstream scientists in the world to get to the recognition that we don't know it all.
And then that was,
yeah.
Rudy just said that.
Yeah.
Dr. Schill, that we talked to in the last hour, he said almost the same thing. He's like, what, I don't know everything? What's going on here? What do you mean? I don't know.
I haven't solved all the great riddles and mysteries of the universe. But, you know, James said, you know, if you really want to solve the riddles and the mysteries of the universe, you at least have to leave yourself open to the possibilities that there are riddles and mysteries, and we haven't solved them all.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, that's sort of self-obvious, but it holds up pretty well.
Yes.
One of the things that I was actually in, like, a junior business class or thing in junior high, and mm-hmm. one of the things that they talked about
Greece?
Was... No, one of the things they talked about was... opportunity cost. Like if you choose to
every waking hour of my college career has just come back through. Thank you, Doug.
I'm sorry, I had
all those
opportunity cost.
I had to flood.
Let's talk about
Keynesian
economics after that, Doug.
Okay, we'll do that right
great.
Next. But the opportunity cost. So you had William James. You had
right.
all these other, you know, eminent scientists running around. Were they perhaps, unfortunately, distracted by the spiritualism movement and the spiritualists? And maybe they could have already solved cancer and solved the hunger crisis, and maybe we would have energy coming to us through the air and we wouldn't have to charge our cell phones. I mean, if they weren't debunking
these
people, was there an opportunity cost? Did we pay a price for that?
I don't think so. I mean, because if you look at why these guys so hold up so well in history, Charles Richer, who was one of the French members of that original psychical research group, won a Nobel Prize for his discovery of anaphylaxis and, you know, immune response. And John Strutler and Rayleigh won a Nobel Prize for his work with atmospheric chemistry,
mm-hmm.
and Oliver Lodge really did develop some of the basic receivers of radio communication, and William James really was one of the world's outstanding philosophers. And the opportunity cost, I think, comes at the other end. If you look at, I was thinking about this actually when you all were talking about it to some extent, but if you look at the structure of a university, it's not just, well, I can make more money or, get more acclaim. It's, I can get tenured and I can have a stable job if I'm working in the mainstream, right? I know this. I work in a university department, and as young faculty come in, one of the things we review every year is, what's your research look like? Can we get you tenured? Are we going to be able to move you forward through the university apparatus? So these guys that I'm talking about, they were brilliant scientists, but it was something that they had by necessity to do part-time, And one of the things for a James or a Rayleigh or a Riche is, when I was talking about burning credibility, they had tons of credibility to burn, right? They could afford to take some of their spare time and work on this. And even though they took some real hits to their reputation, they all surmounted it because they were really brilliant scientists. So I don't think it's cost us a thing. I think that by necessity of the scientific system, it probably cost more at the other end. If you really believe that if they could have done this nothing but full-time, total support from their universities, extreme funding and honor and credibility, mm-hmm. then you might say, what would they have been able to find?
Well, yeah, it's not blaming on the paranormal, Doug. Like, it's not their fault that there's no cure for cancer.
Oh,
and there's no cure for AIDS. You said that. I was like, oh my God. We don't have enough problems already. Now you got to dump all this on your shoulders.
I was stretching
it's
it to me.
It's an interesting idea.
It's an interesting. I've been saying this, I'm really torn on this because I'd like to see a lot more research being put into the paranormal. But one of my favorite comedians, David Cross, does it. It's great. He's made this point on one of his trips where he's like, yeah, so they're going to put a man on the moon again. They're going to put a man. Why don't we put a guy in an apartment? I mean, why don't we try doing that?
There's opportunity cost for you right there.
I understand that point, and I understand that there are a lot of really heavy issues here, real. Interface, that need to be dealt with.
But the thing is, not everyone's going to be a cancer researcher. If you look at, my favorite university example is the University of Virginia, that Ian Stevenson, Emily Kelly group, and they're currently looking at crisis apparitions. And they have tenured positions there. So, and you could go to Emily Kelly, who I happen to kind of like, and say, if you weren't doing this, do you think that you could cure swine flu so we wouldn't be worrying about the next pandemic? Well, she's not trained for that, right? And so one of the things I wonder is that the kind of people who might have, an inclination or an intelligence to get at this, they're going to be consistently steered away from it, right, for the most part. Those positions just aren't there.
No.
And I'm not saying that's a life tragedy, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that someone somewhere is going to have to make a fundamental breakthrough before we see, the current system embrace it. Although, Emily is at the University of Virginia, and they've started a psychical research chair in Norway. You're right that there's more interest in it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the right – I never thought about it that way, that there are people in place – That are handling this. There are people that are researching cancer. There are people that are researching.
They took Charles Tart's position away out in Nevada, and I don't know if they took his position, but they took his what he was studying away, and it's a lot of give and take. But maybe in this particular case, it does have to do with society. As well as, politics, because, a lot of universities are political beings as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it might be society and politics as well. Like, does society expect something to be happening at the university level in this. And until like very modern times, like within 5 years, where all this attention happens in October, and then it, you know, there's TV shows throughout the year and stuff like that, and there's, you know, books like yours coming out, like yours out, talking about this stuff fairly seriously, is, you know, maybe now is the time where University of Virginia could say, you know what, I think we are going to let this research, this branch of research happen. You know, it might be silly, it might not work, it might work, who knows what's going to happen, but we're going to let it go, because in this society right now, as we speak, it's okay to talk about ghosts.
It is now, and we've come to a really good, it's a good time for that. I mean, the taboos, like we've
but
been
10
saying,
years ago, okay. I don't remember it being okay to talk about
I wouldn't
about
mention
ghosts.
It in the workplace.
No.
Never.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's interesting. I mean, I think we are having a legitimate conversation. And I think that's really a good thing.
Yeah.
One more question, I should say, after all this stuff, right? And I don't. It's actually nice for me to actually ask this question to somebody. It begs to be asked. After all this work you did on this fantastic book, do you believe in ghosts now?
I think this. I think the more interesting question about ghosts is why do we see them? And it goes back to what you said earlier. You know, throughout human history, as long as we've been able to record it, we've seen ghosts. And if we could figure out why we see them, then we would understand ourselves in some really fascinating ways and probably the rest of the world. So to me, that's the question I want to answer. You know, not do we believe in them, but why do we see them?
Fantastic.
Interesting.
I couldn't have said that. That's a great way to look at it.
And there are some answers to it. I mean, there's some theories posited to answer that particular question, but I certainly don't know of any that are...
Maybe
you know,
it's, maybe the heat's getting to my brain. I don't know. I mean, but...
I'm so sorry about that.
No. Well, no, I mentioned that Deborah on the break, because you guys were like, oh, we're dying in here.
Well, you know,
I turn the air on, it's not going to get cool in here till the end of the show anyway, so you're not sweating out, right?
Cryptically, though, I always answer cryptically when somebody says, you know, oh, I saw a ghost, or oh, this weird thing happened. I always answer cryptically so that people think I know more than I really do. And I say something like, then you were meant to see that ghost.
Ooh.
And I actually believe that. I mean, I really do believe that if somebody saw a ghost, they were meant to see the ghost. But there's a lot more to that answer
it's a
huge question, you know.
It's a really
like, why did this happen to me? Well, you were meant to have that happen to you, you know.
Unfortunately, we are at the end of the show. I wanted to mention this. I heard this last night. I looked it up just a second ago. B. Arthur passed away yesterday.
Oh, I know.
Did you hear about that, Deborah?
Yeah, I saw that.
What a bummer. You know, I'm going to take shots for this probably, but I was a Golden Girls fan. That was a hilarious show, man.
The Golden Girls.
That show
was wonderful.
B. Arthur was awesome in that, and I heard that news yesterday, and I was like, no way. What a bummer. Passed away at 86, Golden Girls Beatrice Arthur.
Well, her career does not have to end, because this is Ghostly Talk after all.
Yeah, well,
with any show, she's going to come on any show. It'll be ours next. And,
yeah, definitely.
You know,
try to get B. Arthur out here.
B, we are going to miss you a lot.
Yeah, she was so much fun.
And very teased. I mean, people teased her a lot for her voice, her gravelly voice.
But she was hilarious.
Yeah,
but she
voice.
Was so funny, and, you know, well, one thing that's not funny.
That's
though.
A way to end a show on a bummer. Yeah.
One thing that's
always good to do that.
One thing that's not as funny as B. Arthur's comedy is Ghost Hunters, William James, and the scientific search for life after
that's
death.
That's a wonderful save.
That is serious. And Deborah Bloom, you did such a fantastic job with that.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for hanging out with us. Yeah. And
but do hang on the line for
Don't leave us just yet.
Just a bit, because we're going to close out, and then, you know, before we click, you know, the phone off.
Okay.
great.
See, there's this thing called a telephone.
I'm not going to get into that depth. But I do
Doug invented?
Doug invented. along with the wheel. We made two discoveries tonight, Doug and Van, the wheel and the telephone.
Yes, back in my childhood days in the mid-1800s. I have to say thank you, Robbie Thomas, for coming on the show and telling us about the upcoming Can-Am Paracon, the Canadian-American Paranormal Conference coming up. And then, of course, Dr. Schild, who
Rudy Schild, yeah, wow.
I mean, that DVD, you've got to, what is it, Laughlin, Nevada?
I'll put the link up on
DVD,
the UFO Conference.
Yeah, UFO Conference DVD, you've got to get that, because if it's anything like the hour that we spent with Dr. Schild, it's going to be phenomenal.
Yep.
And, of course, Deborah Blum, thank you so much for coming on
the
show.
Thanks for joining us.
We've got links.
It was really a pleasure, thanks.
Excellent. We've got links up at ghostlytalk.com,
which, of course,
is our website, to all the websites and everything related to this show. And I have to thank each and every person for listening to this on your iPods, on the actual radio, on the computer, however you've
listened. All the rubbernecks in chat, thanks for hanging out there and making fun of us. We appreciate that.
Thank you, everybody. So we're going to be back next week with even more guests. Wonderful stuff coming up next week. But until then, I have to say, that's it. I'm totally out.
That's all you got?
My brain.
The heat.
Just,
yeah, you're burning.
My
your...
button just popped
How
out.
About
my turkey
this
button.
Is Doug?
This has been Ghostly Talk. This is Scott out.
And this has been Doug.
And I'm Bonnie.
See you guys next week.